Hello, I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to Sounds Like Canada. Coming up this morning, green tea and grape juice, cancer fighters. We will talk about foods that fight cancer. How do we decipher which foods may reduce the risk of the disease and how much of them to consume and in what combination? Richard Béliveau co-authored a book about preventing cancer through diet. In fact, it is called Foods That Fight Cancer. He wants to convince us, in his words, that a diet based on the constant intake of foods rich in anti-cancer compounds represents an indispensable weapon in the fight against cancer. That's ahead on Sounds Like Canada in 30 minutes from now. To close this morning, the creator and a star of Little Mosque on the Prairie, the much-heralded and hyped CBC TV series, which debuts tonight, also known in Bill Richardson parlance as Corner Halal. But first, to Cape Town and the Good Doctor. Near the close of 2006, I spoke with Stephen Lewis, and it was just a few weeks before he stepped down as the United Nations Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. One of the questions I asked him was why he thought the number of people with AIDS continues to grow, even though people and governments are so aware of the crisis. And here's what he said.
Millions and millions infected, 40 million infected now. It just seems difficult to focus, difficult to galvanize, to mobilize, to recognize that it will go on forever unless you intervene dramatically at a given moment in time.
That's Stephen Lewis. Two people who have witnessed the tragedy of the AIDS pandemic firsthand are Julia Kim and Paul Pronick. They are doctors from Canada who have spent the last 9 years in South Africa doing just what Stephen Lewis was talking about, intervening. Their research and work in rural communities has pointed to some of the root causes of the crisis, poverty and gender equality. Recently, they've had their research published in the medical journal The Lancet. And Paul Pronick and Julia Kim join me this morning from Cape Town, South Africa. Good morning. Well, it's not morning where you are.
Good morning, Sheila. How are you?
Good morning.
Very well, thanks. Paul, you're on the front lines of what Stephen Lewis has been speaking of. You both are. What goes through your mind when you hear someone speak with such despair about Africa?
When we first arrived in the country back in 1998, we ended up in one of the poorest, most marginalized regions of the country, an area where water and electricity are still real issues, where begging for food is a real problem, where 50% of children don't actually get through high school, if not worse than that. And in that context, people have so many competing priorities, and HIV is just one of many, many, many things that people are dealing with. In 1998, when we first arrived at the small hospital where we work near the Mozambique and Zimbabwe border in what's known as South Africa's Limpopo province, you couldn't even get an HIV test. It was a time when infection rates were really low, and we knew this thing was coming because it was present in other parts of Africa for a decade earlier, yet because of apartheid in South Africa, it never really crossed the border. The last place you'd want to be as a black Tanzanian national, for example, where the epidemic originated, back in the mid-1980s, the last place you'd want to be under apartheid was South Africa. So in many ways, it protected the country from the introduction of HIV into the country, so we knew it was coming. Mm. But at the same time, because what apartheid did in terms of just decimating the social and political landscape and really creating extremely difficult issues of poverty and social instability and migrant labor, it sowed the seeds for what was one of the world's most explosive epidemics. And in the area where we're working now, between 1 in 3 people to 1 in 4 people or adults are HIV positive, which is just massive.
Julia, you must face that despair regularly yourself.
It's a sort of both, Sheila. I mean, I really resonate with what Stephen Lewis is saying, and I think the challenge to those of us who are working here is how do you maintain that the immediacy and passion but also maintain a long-term vision and commitment. You know, it's sort of a balancing act. You don't want to burn out, but at the same time, you do need to sort of keep passionate and not feel that despair. And I think what Paul was saying as well is, you know, you look at the public response, the global response to something like the tsunami when it hit, a massive devastation that took place over a very short period, you know, hours. I think it's much easier to get people to mobilize a response and energy and enthusiasm over that kind of a time frame rather than something that's really like a daily tsunami, except spread out over decades.
Stephen Lewis spoke to exactly that point, Julia. Hope is something that would fuel passion. Where do you find hope?
Well, surprisingly enough, it's in the daily things. You know, the images that we see of Africa when we watch the news in Canada is the really depressing images of AIDS orphans and the really thin, emaciated people. But actually out here, when you get out here and work in the rural areas, particularly with rural women, which has been our target group, it's actually very hopeful. People are getting on with their lives. So for me, it's been getting that energy and sort of putting things in place that allow people to take that enthusiasm and make practical changes in their lives that will impact on HIV, both in the short term and the long term. And in, around our work, that's been really addressing basic needs, poverty, looking at women's status in society, looking at domestic violence. And if you can make small changes there, people do have the hope and the optimism to keep going with it.
I have the two of you in a studio in Cape Town huddled around one microphone, but you don't mind being huddled, do you?
No, it's kind of like being cuddled.
I should add at this point that Dr. Pranik and Dr. Kim are married. How did you meet Paul?
We met in medical school. We actually ran against each other for class president, and I lost dismally to Julia.
I wanted to set the tone for the relationship early.
And?
Oh, say no more. No more.
What was your impulse, Julia, to come to Africa?
I guess it started when I was in medical school at University of Manitoba. I had the chance to do what they call an elective, which is where you get to go away. It can be in Canada or elsewhere. And I got interested in going to West Africa, to Ghana. And that was really my first exposure to a developing country. And I had such a positive experience there. I was so welcomed into the community where I was working. And I realized that the tools that I was learning in medical school could be put to possibly better use in a country where there were really huge problems. So that really inspired me to keep going. I went through my internal medicine training in Massachusetts after that, where there was also a huge HIV epidemic happening. And it was there, actually, ironically, in a first world country, that I started to realize that poverty and violence and sort of despair were fueling the epidemic among, again, not the white middle class, but among the poor, among people of color. And that in turn inspired me to study public health, which was to really not just look at what I can do as a doctor with my own stethoscope, mm-hmm. but to really take a much broader view and understand why populations are at risk rather than individuals.
And Paul, your focus became rural. Why?
Well, we came to South Africa originally as volunteers with the United Nations Development Program. Again, it was around 1998, and South Africa actually supplies Canada with most of its doctors up in the north now. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, South Africa had a program that tried to fill some of the capacity gaps in rural areas. So they, just like Canada, have great difficulty attracting doctors out to remote settings. So we came through the UN to this remote rural area, where a major South African university has a rural research station. And they hosted us, and we basically spent the first couple of years training nurses to be doctors, because in most clinics, in the area where we live, there's a million people in an area that's 30 kilometers by 30 kilometers, and there's about 45 primary healthcare clinics there, and not a single one of them has a doctor. And your average hospital, a 500-bed hospital that we work at, which is a big hospital for Canada, will be served by three or four doctors when we originally arrived. So there was just a major capacity gap, which is how we ended up in working in the rural areas. And then, of course, after finding a lot of our experience in South Africa resonating with the stuff that Julie was talking about experiences in Massachusetts, other experience in Africa, experience that I had working up in northern Canada on some of the reserves, and again, dealing with the profound social issues and the way in which they interact and influence health problems, we began to look at sort of broader approaches to some of the priority issues. And at that time, HIV was really emerging as the major priority issue in South Africa. Mm-hmm.
Stephen Lewis has spoken not only about the recognition of the crisis that needs to happen, but also the need to intervene. What does intervention mean to you, Paul?
Well, in many ways, the global effort around HIV interventions right now are around disaster mitigation. Again, using that tsunami analogy, we want to put pills in mouths, this idea that we can, you know, save people from dying, prevent people from being orphans, and so forth. But the much slower process of rebuilding after the tsunamis hit, or of preventing further tsunamis from happening, is a much more long-term, much more difficult process. So from our standpoint, intervening means, on the one hand, this immediate crisis management, which is putting people on medications and setting up health systems to support that and so forth. But on the other hand, it's a much slower process of prevention. So a lot of the work that we've been doing, again, tries to address issues of poverty and gender inequalities, some of the driving forces behind the epidemic. The program that we've recently been involved in for about the last 6 or 7 years looks at the way in which, for example, giving bank loans to poor women, access to credit for the development of income-generating projects, can actually affect their vulnerability to HIV and to gender-based violence. And that's the work that you referred to earlier that was recently published in The Lancet, that shows, you know, through trying to economically empower women, you can cut rates of domestic violence in half. Which is something that hasn't really been shown before globally, and something that has a major potential to contribute towards reducing some of the real driving forces behind HIV in South Africa.
Julia, give me the connection between gender inequality and the spread of AIDS.
Sure, Sheila. I think the first 2 decades of this epidemic, we really looked at just getting the behavior change messages out there. And in South Africa and elsewhere, we talk about the ABCs, abstain, be faithful, use condoms. But I think our understanding of behavior change has become more sophisticated over the years. And we're realizing that it's not just about changing an individual's knowledge about HIV, but really understanding the context of their lives. And in South Africa, for women who are the highest risk group, particularly young women, your ability to abstain from sex can be quite limited. There was a study here in Cape Town, actually, that showed that about 1 in 4 women said their first sexual experience was forced or coerced. So it wasn't actually voluntary. It wasn't wanted. So what does it mean to tell a 15-year-old you must abstain until you're married, when actually that first experience is not of her own choice? Similarly, being faithful is quite difficult. We live in a system, as Paul mentioned, where apartheid has left a legacy of migrant labor. So a lot of families are separated for about 10 months of the year, and they do set up other partnerships, almost other families, around the mines where they're migrating. So being faithful can be quite difficult. And using condoms, again, is quite fraught for women who are in an abusive relationship or where the man is bringing the money home. Just to raise the issue of a condom in that kind of a relationship often sort of implies that one partner is being unfaithful, and it can provoke beatings within the home as well. So we really try to address some of these gender issues, the power imbalances between men and women that are driving the epidemic in this country.
The South African government has been one of the slowest and most resistant governments to even acknowledge the AIDS crisis. Julia, what kind of response have you had to open talk about violence and gender inequality that's been so rooted in this country?
Well, I think it's actually, this is one of the areas where the South African government is quite frankly addressing domestic violence and rape. They see it as a priority issue in the country. I think also Thabo Mbeki really did try to draw out the links between poverty and HIV/AIDS early on, but that, as people know, really got twisted and turned around in the press into all sorts of different messages about HIV not causing AIDS and so on. And I think that delayed a lot of the responses at a time when it was quite critical to act. I think the government is now changing. There's really positive signs that they are taking HIV quite seriously. There's no more debates around whether HIV causes AIDS, that sort of disappeared. And they're on the ground, government is actually doing quite a bit to try and roll out antiretrovirals and to try and take these issues seriously. The government is now looking at their national AIDS policy for the next 5 years, and they are looking at things like gender inequalities and violence as part of that strategy. I think the challenge now is to find really practical ways of implementing that so that it doesn't become just words on paper.
Paul, did you want to comment on that? I thought well, I heard I think, a sharp intake of breath across
yeah,
the
no,
ocean.
I think it's just too easy to criticize the South African government. I mean, if you know, faced with the kind of challenges on so many levels that they're faced with, it's easy to point. You know, it's easy to point fingers at them on one hand to try to hope that they can address HIV as comprehensively as we could in Canada or some other developed country. But the fact of the matter is South Africa's got the most ambitious AIDS treatment program in the world. They have more people on antiretrovirals than anywhere else on the planet right now. And that's a program that's only began, you know, 2 years ago. They have the most progressive constitution in human history. They're ranked number 11 in the world in terms of the proportion of women parliamentarians. They are, you know, making very concrete steps to address some of the drivers of the epidemic. They're the most economically stable, robust country in Africa. So there's a lot of things that are really looking up for South Africa that gives us pause for hope and for optimism, despite, I think, some of the ways in which South Africa is, I think, too easily portrayed in the media as dragging its heels around HIV.
One of the questions I put to Stephen Lewis was what good he feels has come from all the conferences, the seminars about AIDS that have been held all over the world. Can I just play you a minute of what he said to me?
They mean something. You've got to have these gatherings where declarations emerge against which you can pin the behavior of government and embarrass them or shame them or remind them. But I have to tell you, Sheila, that the pattern of self-indulgent, narcissistic conference going and seminar discussing and report writing, repeating the same stuff over and over and over again while the work doesn't get done on the ground, that's when I really feel I want to throttle people. It's as though we've decided on a massive admixture of meetings as a substitute for action. And I know the epidemiologists and the scientists and the activists and the politicians and the advocates, they all have to get together from time to time. But if you asked the Africans, they would say, get the job done at country level. We want to save lives, not write another report.
Julia, between you and Paul, you've written dozens and dozens of medical articles. No doubt you've gone to a lot of conferences too, but you're very much in the field. What do you make of what Stephen Lewis just said?
You know, Paul and I were just laughing and looking at each other because I think we also have the same feeling. You know, the AIDS conference in Toronto, which was the most recent one, is, you know, bringing together thousands and thousands of people at great expense. And at the end of the day, you do feel like, where is this money really gone and what could we be doing? And I think it does come down to, you know, in a way it's become an industry. This is a side of the work that people don't talk about very much. But there is an AIDS industry to this, where there's a lot of research money, a lot of money going to pharmaceutical companies, a lot of conferences, a lot of publications, and it's become a bit of a business. And then within that maelstrom, a lot of times the actual work and the actual concerns of people can get left out. I think the one saving grace, I would say, that's come out of the International AIDS conferences is that probably unlike almost any other scientific conference, it has brought together activists, civil society, people from communities to really sort of say this is what needs to happen on the ground. To what extent that's actually impacted, I couldn't say, but I think it's been an attempt to get those two different worlds together. I think there's a lot more that we could be doing with conferences, to be honest, Sheila. I think a lot of times people go there and sort of use it to promote results of studies, but we aren't asking why have things failed, what could we be doing better, what are the linkages that we want to be making on the ground. And there I think Stephen Lewis's comment about doing things at a national level is quite important. You know, to have even African countries, many of them can't afford to have conferences that would bring together all the actors within a country to say, to take stock and say, where should we be going? What research would be useful? How are we implementing programs? And that might be a more effective way to use that kind of money.
I want to ask, just in terms of, we talk about what a country can do on a national basis. Tell me what Canadians can do on an individual basis, Paul, to, if I may use the word, intervene?
Goodness, that's an almost impossible question to answer. I think, on the one hand, just being conscious of the issues is quite important, and recognizing the interdependence of relationships as they exist internationally. For example, a lot of the driving forces that we talked about around HIV with respect to, for example, poverty in South Africa, which really does fuel HIV in ways that are complex but very direct. Poverty is not something that you could look at as purely a national phenomena anymore. International relationships are absolutely fundamental in terms of fueling third world poverty, and that it's not just something as simple as things like third world debt and debt relief and so forth. It's also things like farm subsidies, for example. Huge numbers of Canadians are farmers. Huge numbers of Americans are farmers. The European Union, the common agricultural policy there, right now $300 billion are spent every year to subsidize people to grow crops that they otherwise wouldn't be able to grow. That's enough to fly every cow around the world once a year by plane, first class. So if you're a farmer farming corn in Zambia, and corn from Ohio is getting dumped onto the African market because these guys can grow it at a loss, and normally these are not small farmers that get these subsidies, these are big conglomerates and big companies, you know, all of a sudden it's no longer profitable for that Zambian farmer to grow maize or to grow corn, so he's got to go and work in the copper mine. It sets this whole cycle in motion that's incredibly important to understand. So I do think that understanding some of the broader sort of social and political issues and the way in which Canada's foreign policy is linked to some of these more complex issues that relate to the status of developing countries is quite critical to understand in terms of HIV.
Thank you both very much for joining me today to contribute to that understanding. I appreciate it. I hate taking you away from your work, but thank you very much.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks, Sheila.
Julia Kim and Paul Pronick are Canadian doctors working in South Africa, and they join me from Cape Town. And incidentally, Julia, besides being a doctor, you've been a violinist. You've got an electric violin, and you play with the group Mondetta. Do you ever get a chance to play anymore?
I do, actually. I tend to bring it with me now, even to the conferences and the meetings, just to see if there might be a jam session or something happening. And often there is, so I do bring it out, and I continue to play when I'm in Cape Town.
Well, good. Let's hear some music now. Here's Julia Kim and Mondetta. Music by Mondetta, featuring Julia Kim, Dr. Julia Kim, on violin. Ahead in the next half hour of Sounds Like Canada, I'll be speaking with Richard Béliveau. He co-authored a book about the foods that fight cancer. Please stay with us. We'll be back after the break.